This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Kevin, yesterday did a wonderful job explaining and demonstrating how we could overlap post-socialist and the post-colonial conceptual frameworks. I want to offer a different engagement with the post-colonial and the post-socialist. I want to treat them less as forms of optics that could be, as lenses that could be overlapped, and more as different frequencies, so to speak, that transmit distinctive images. I'm less interested in what post-coloniality is, but I am really interested in what post-coloniality actually does, namely what kind of resonances it generates, what kind of impacts it produces, and what kind of consequences it engenders. Why post-coloniality? It's based on the fieldwork that I've been conducting in the last almost a decade. By now, I started in Belarus, and then I also did some fieldwork in Kyrgyzstan, so in Minsk and Bishkek. And post-communism, just as a conceptual framework and a system of explanations, just doesn't let me ask the questions I am interested in asking. And today, I'm going to talk about one particular aspect of this material. It's photography-based. And again, like, it happened pretty much by accident. Until I went to Minsk, I never heard of the Minsk School of Creative Photography. But then one interviewee after another kind of started telling me about that, and in the end I thought, like, well, I guess I need to go and find those creative photographers, which I did, and sort of, like, you'll see what comes out of it. So, let me start. I knew I had to do it. This is how Andrei Linkevich, a visual artist from Minsk, explained to me the history of his Double Heroes. It's the name of the photograph. The photograph provoked quite a stir in Belarus when an independent Minsk gallery showed it in 2012 as a part of Linkevich's massive photo project called Goodbye Motherland. As Linkevich recalled it, the leading philosopher of the Belarusian opposition, Valentin Akudovich, whose quote you see here, highly praised the work and by saying, finally, someone showed it. Other viewers were no less excited, but instead of praising the artist, they threatened to sue him for denigrating the memory of the Second World War. To be honest, Linkevich continued in 2014 in an interview that I conducted with him, I really hope that 15 years from now, Double Heroes would be on the walls of our national museums, because it is a fundamentally important photograph for me and for our society in general. So what is so fundamentally important about Double Heroes? The color photograph is a double, static double, oops, let's see if it works. No. Okay. It's a color photograph, a static double portrait of two male soldiers cropped at their waists. The men stare intensely, yet patiently. It's something that is located on their eye level, but beyond the limits of the picture. Their faces look identical, their postures are identical too. Their uniforms, while clearly different, also show strong family resemblance. Both men have similar field caps, shoulder straps, rows of metal buttons, and so on. This exercise in the formal repetition, however, is radically undermined by two minor elements. The man on the left has a Soviet Red Star on his field cap, while the man on the right has the German Eagle embroidered above his right breast pocket. And if you enlarge it enough, you'll see how the swastika is carefully blurred. A formal repetition turns out to be a production of an ideological conflict, a visually harmonized combination of existential enemies. But there is a certain calmness, if not coldness, in the way these two men are presented. There is no animosity or even a slight hint of attention in the photograph. In fact, the double portrait delivers a strong objectivist message. It doesn't judge, it just lists available historical alternatives. Partly, this distancing effect is an outcome of the frame's visual structure. By positioning the soldiers diagonally, away from each other and away from the viewer, Linkevich transforms the canonical military portrait. The usual theatrical body display in front of the camera and the beholder morphed here into an absorptive depiction of the characters looking awry. And this is just an example of Admiral Kolchak. This transformation of internal conventions of the portrait genre significantly influences the external perception of the photograph. The skewed orientation of the figures and their skewed looks frustrate the possibility of the visual exchange between the eyes of the personages and the eye of the viewer. The visual orientation of the personages is in discord with the position of the viewer, who is being forced to divide his or her attention between the two equally meaningful figures. The soldiers are posing, inviting the gaze, but they are not posing for the viewer or of the photograph. In fact, they purposefully ignore the viewer. This pictorial disengagement is amplified further by the deliberate erasure of the photographic context. In the photograph, the soldiers are placed against an empty off-white background that suggests no vanishing point, which could have provided a sense of depth and could incorporate the viewer into the picture. The absence of shadows makes the appearance of the double even more decontextualized. Neither from the point of view of the internal geometry, an absent vanishing point, nor from the point of view of its narrative organization, soldiers looking askance, does Double Hero offer a logical entry into the frame. As a result, the viewer's perspective is fundamentally unsettled. There is no historical context to interpret, there is no clear vantage point to assume, and there is no obvious visual path to complete. Without a clear-cut perspective, the viewer is suspended in a state of an epistemological confusion and visual uncertainty. Could these double heroes be twin brothers? Are they saying that for each Red Army soldier, one could easily find a local collaborator with the Nazis? Or is this double portrait a portrait of the double agents, or Stirlitz of sort? And if so, are we supposed to read the repetition of a diachronic transformation of the same person from the communist left to the Nazi right? Is this photograph an allegory of the nation which is doomed to be stuck with politically incompatible regimes? Or is this a visual meditation on the benefits and pitfalls of survival through acts of transformative mimicry? And whose heroes are the soldiers anyway? In Double Heroes, I explore the theme of a neutral scholarly attitude towards the history of the Second World War. Linkevich clarified his analytical approach in a public interview. The source of inspiration for the work was a TV story about a historical reenactors in Belarus. As the artist told me, the majority of these reenactors actually have two full sets of the uniform. One is the fascist, and the other one is the Soviet. Depending on the need, they could perform on either side during a reenactment. All they could care about was authenticity of their buttons, the proper shoulder straps, and the exact overall outlook. For them, it made no difference whatsoever what side to fight on. This struck me to the point of sheer madness. Namely, there is this someone who could go fight the fascists today and the Soviets tomorrow. So he decided to take a picture of one of these guys, one of these reenactors in his own uniform. So Linkevich's conflation of history and spectacle, of the past and the present, is indicative. History is not quite history yet. The war past still plays itself out, today or even tomorrow. Hence, any attempt to present a reenactment as a playful costume drama is suspicious, if not maddening. It must be neutralized by being reframed in terms of a moral choice, or at least its impossibility. Despite his sheer madness, Linkevich painstakingly staged and documented the condition of epistemological indifference of his subject, taking a spectacle of reenacted battles for a paradigm of historical detachment from the events that rarely leave anybody neutral. What is crucial here is that this affection is achieved not through a usual fantasy of escape or self-erasure from history, but through the inactive inhabiting of the available historical forms of historical representation. Double Heroes are indeed about the double's heroic ability to fit fundamentally different uniforms and scenarios without losing face. The fundamental importance of Double Heroes then has to do with at least two crucial moments. First, the photograph usefully visualizes a contemporary trend of anesthetizing painful historical moments through their meticulously choreographed reproductions. The past is decontextualized and isolated. It is reduced to its material indices, buttons, belts, chevrons, and so on. This reduction, however, is not necessarily an operation of simplification. Rather, it is a mode of transcoding. History is approached as a museum of perceptible objects, as a gallery of ready-made pieces, which could be reappropriated, reassembled, and reactivated. In place of memory, there are mnemonic objects. This focus on various aspects of materiality makes possible another dramatic shift from social context and social relations to textures, colors, shapes, sounds, volumes, and so on. Facts become overshadowed by what Russian avant-garde artists of the 1920s called faktura, that is, by the tangible characteristics of historical artifacts. As Double Heroes makes it clear, what really distinguishes one man from another is neither the individuality of their faces nor the specificity of their surrounding, but the distinctive ornamentalism of their sartorial details. Difference is not a manifestation of some deep essence anymore. It is a result of relations between the elements on the surface. Secondly, Double Heroes offers an important model of subjectivity too, both within and outside the frame. And Lienkiewicz's reliance on the genre of the portrait is crucial here. Unlike many forms of mimetic representation, the portrait blurs the distinction between the medium and the object of representation, at least usually. The traditional role of the portrait is to convey, in fact, to document visually the referent, the person. However, in the case of Double Heroes, the careful realism of the photograph exploits the conventions of the portrait only to radically subvert it from within. By doubling the face, Lienkiewicz transforms it into a placeholder. Creating the surplus of the individual, the duplication effectively functions as its erasure. Or to be more precise, the method of duplication works here as an operation of unmasking. Mimetic realism results in semantic opacity. No differential relationship between the two faces could be easily established. This defacement as unmasking does suggest a certain double logic, though. The doubling of the face could be read as a pictorial articulation of the idea that there is no self prior to socially demarcated existence. In other words, without the signifying stamp of the uniform, all faces are alike. There could be an opposite interpretation, of course. The reappearing face is a symbol of the ontological constancy that deprives signs of political belonging from any referential quality. Uniforms are just examples of camouflaging outfits, easy to replace during the masquerade of survival. In either case, the semantic ambivalence of the face in Double Heroes provides a structural possibility for the comparative analysis of the two figures. Through transforming the facial features into a repeatable formula, the act of defacement highlights the individual's ability to serve as a corporeal vehicle for incompatible ideological signs. The traditional balance between the epistemic and the pictorial that characterizes the portrait is completely shattered. The genre is utilized not to represent the referent, but to materialize its non-transparency, if not its absence. Withholding any hints of a solution for the depicted dilemma, Lienkiewicz's heroes leave the story about the portrait's constitutive duality open. They draw our attention to epistemological and identificatory possibilities that might reside in constant oscillation between the alternatives, in various techniques of non-alignment, and in diverse practices of the dispassionate embodying of historically available shapes. Reproducing historical formulas and visual cliches, Lienkiewicz objectifies the past. The photograph's semantic opacity is used as a foundation for building a complex syntax of visual relations between the viewer and the double portrait. His Double Heroes is a form of reported speech, a deliberate exercise in practicing a borrowed language. Using Lienkiewicz's Double Heroes as my point of departure, in the remaining time, I will analyze a specific technology of self-objectification and self-presentation that took shape in Belarus before and after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I will be dealing with the works of two prominent contemporary photographers, Sergei Kozhemiakin and Igor Savchenko, who are associated with the so-called Minsk School of Creative Photography, which emerged in the end of the 1980s. In both cases, the photographers build their archives by actively transforming visual materials of the Soviet period. I'm interested in studying various techniques of post-colonial appropriation through which Minsk photographers and visual artists critically reclaimed and refocused visual languages of the Soviet past. I will refer to this technology as vicarious photography to make apparent both the ready-made nature of its sources and the type of indirect and in-mask subjectivity that it portrays. The vicarious, borrowed, and appropriated nature of these visual sources is important. In fact, it nicely reflects the overall problem of the process of decolonization, aptly formulated by Frantz Fanon more than 60 years ago. I quote, "Whether he likes it or not, the black man has to wear the livery the white man fabricated for him." More recently, Gayatri Spivak translated the same problem into the language of representation. Her famous "Can the Subaltern Speak?" emphasized the fact that the vocabulary of expressive forms available to the subaltern classes tends to be underprivileged. And also, and more significantly, to be heard, to be understood, subaltern groups are forced to speak the language of the institutions and the regimes that dominate them. To put it differently, the livery has to be appropriated in order to be transformed from within. The visual materials allow me to trace how a particular historical experience, how a particular historical experience fights against the limits of already existing genres. Visual interventions do not happen in a vacuum. They tend to be constrained by available vocabulary of expressive forms, plot structures, syntactic conventions, and so on. In my case, this enabling and constraining framework is the genre of the individual group portrait. Yet, as I just showed with Double Heroes, portraits could be evoked not to individualize the depicted personality, but to deface this individual. And as I claim, this defacing appropriation has a certain narrative coherence. Images of decapitated or faceless individuals point to a particular form of presence without identification. They visualize subjectivity without agency, but with a lot of self-reflexivity. So I will try to show, to repeat Lisitsky, how Belarusian photographers circle around the portrait, that is to say, how they reproduce and at the same time transform the livery that they inherited. So, let's do some mental exercise. Try to imagine, so I'll give you sort of a prompt, try to imagine. A man in the military uniform poses for the camera. He stands in the corner of an open terrace somewhere high in the Crimean mountains with the sea far below. One of his hands firmly holds the terrace's railing. The other is casually placed on his waist. The photo is perfectly composed. The horizontal rows of the railings are structurally balanced by the vertical of the officer's body. And the sea in the background merges with the sky, creating a seamless airy plane. So, did you imagine? It works. The portrait would have been a typical example of a holiday picture from a summer resort, except for one crucial detail that is missing, the man's head. The figure is cropped right at the officer's shoulders. Did you imagine something like that? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, despite this violent erasure of the subject, the photograph is disturbingly serene. Relaxed, if headless, the figure exudes confidence and even a sense of control. The photo is called Presence, Присутствие, and it is a part of the series called A Family Album by the Minsk photographer Sergei Kozhemyakin. In my interview with him in Minsk, I asked why he decided to decapitate the officer. He insisted that there was no alteration whatsoever. I would never allow myself to cut the head of my brother off, and suggested his own reading of the image. In 1989, when he started working on the album, presence, присутствие, was a term routinely used to refer to the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan, as in присутствие ограниченного контингента, the presence of a limited army contingent. Kozhemyakin fused a political cliché with the ready-made image of his brother, a military officer, offering a play with a stereotype, as he called it. His playful appropriation transformed the mechanical cut by the camera into a conceptual tool of sorts. The confident self-presentation of the body, unencumbered by the presence of mind, created a visual allegory for the unpopular and badly conceived military invasion. The image was certainly a certificate of presence, as Roland Barthes defined photography, but this presence certified the absence of the subject. It was a presence that made identification with the depicted individual quite impossible. There is another type of absence that this re-photographed portrait conveyed. Kozhemyakin's own authorial presence in the production of this photograph is strikingly immaterial. He activates a visual record of the past without leaving any traces of his own intervention, or his own presence for that matter. The visual record of the past is reenacted but not appropriated. The author prefers to stay outside the frame dealing with history from a distance. This retrospective activation of the photographic record captures well the techniques of figuration that were elaborated by visual artists at the Minsk School of Photography before and after the collapse of the Soviet Union. They emptied subjects, defaced but camouflaged, presented subjectivity as a vocabulary of poses and costumes that could deliver their semantic effect even when the identity of the performer could not be established. Because of its vicarious nature, this secondhand photography draws attention not to the expressive but to the editorial capacities of the vicarious photographer. Found photographs are selected, combined, and visually transformed, producing a post-factum archive of the period that is gone. Such post-colonial archives rely on visual analogs of reported speech, demonstrating their constitutive dependency on premediated forms of expression. The derivative quality of this visual production vividly exposes the paraphrasing devices, such as refocalization, resequencing, recomposing, or tonal flattening, and I will be talking about that in a minute, through which the available historical records are recaptured. In a sense, they offer us a set of techniques of dealing with the past that cannot be completely erased or rewritten. The interventions are done from within. But the effects, nonetheless, the effect is crucial for undermining the original conventions of representation. Bill Ashcroft, in his study of postcolonial cultures in Latin America, usefully observes that the colonized culture could absorb dominant forms by, I quote, making them bear the burden of a different experience. Such tactical occupations, as he calls them, deploy dominant representations against the culture of origin in order to control frames and forms of self-representation. So let me go back to Kazhemiakin's album to show how he performs this, his art of tactical occupation. As I mentioned, the family album is based on ready-made photographs, and its subtitle, Real Photographs from Real Life, 1953-1989, pointedly emphasized the documentary quality of these instances of reported speech. All the photos were found in the archives of Kazhemiakin's parents and his brother. In the series, he assumes a position of externality vis-a-vis the genre and history. His own authorial presence, as I mentioned, is not manifested directly, but the photographs that he carefully selected do expose the work of the photographic medium. The framing and structuring intrusions of the camera are unmistakable here. It is indicative that Kazhemiakin rejected the usual organizational conventions of the family album. The real life in this album that he created is not structured by the linear chronology. There is no diachronic progression as we usually see it in sort of normal family album. Nor does it trace a biography of a particular individual. This real life ostensibly lacks leading heroes and recognizable historical events. Moreover, close-up portraits of relatives, the dominant genre of a typical family album, are entirely missing. Instead, the series presents snapshots of familiar everyday scenes in which people are photographed from a distance and often from above. Their faces are not usually disfigured, but they do not act as logical focal points of the photos either. Instead, the photographer's gaze focuses on peripheral elements, sort of like our attention is purposefully diffused. Just to demonstrate how it's done, I'll show you this one. It's a typical example. So it's called Troika, right? But in order really to comprehend sort of the meaning of the photograph, you need to trace it. Troika, right? So like, you need kind of to follow the message. The image doesn't have sort of a clear center. In a sense, this album of ready-made photographs presents a particular view on history that celebrates the eccentric and the marginal. Just to give you another example, I want to emphasize, though, that this resistance to cohere and the avoidance of any thematic or temporal commitment that the family album highlights are not random, right? They are carefully planned effects of Kazhemiakin's compositional strategy. They are indeed expressions of postcolonial presence in which the imperial past is rarely perceived as a sequence of frontal portraits organized in a narrative progression. Just to remind you, for instance, like these ones, right? History neither gels nor crystallizes here, but it makes itself available indirectly, obliquely, fragmentary, and often out of focus. So what we see in this album on the structural level is a productive embrace of the method of duplication. However, copying and replication do not reconfirm the equivalence with the copied original. The duplication does not reinforce the continuity with the original. Instead, it introduces an unsettling ambiguity. Another work by Kazhemiakin, his transformation of an image, shows this especially well. Technically, the photograph is not portrait as such, but rather it is a serial portraiture of a canonic monument of standing Vladimir Lenin. Four copies of the same photograph were developed separately before they were assembled and rephotographed as a single image. So we have like multiple duplications here. The compositional structure of transformation is deceptively transparent. Its thin white grid neatly brings together and isolates four identical segments in which a vertical figure of Lenin functions as the visual and semantic focus. In spite of the organizing grid, changes in light intensity of each frame are not linear. The sequence image suggests no obvious way to begin, though it's tempting to read the composition as a progression from the bright days of Leninism to its twilight. The differential toning of the empty space is minimalist in its technique, but it is critical in its impact. The tonal modification of the segments gradually flattens the sculpture. As the shadows become more and more leveled, the three-dimensional Lenin loses its depth and becomes a cardboard thin silhouette. From being referential, Lenin quickly devolves into being simulacral. It's all done because of the change of tone. The tonal changes are not just semantic. Changes of tone suggest a new trajectory of reading too. To maintain its meaning, each iteration of the sculpture must be read differentially now, against and along the sculptures in context in other segments. The decentering effect of this transformation is even more pronounced when the series is approached as a single image. In the center of the series, there is a void, a cross, pointedly emphasized by intersecting lines of the wide grid. As the compositional structure of transformation suggests, the spatial center neither generates nor anchors the explanation for the series anymore. In order to understand the composition, one has to approach it eccentrically. This image helpfully foregrounds the importance of the open deployment of the semantic and the artistic potential of the photographic surface. The surface is converted into an autonomous tool of expression. Or to put it slightly differently, the surface became transformed into a multi-layered visual screen that could display signs of the process of the appropriation of the medium. We see how the livery is getting deconstructed through various forms of ornament and embroidery, right? The subaltern finds a formal way to indicate traces of its presence. To appreciate fully the importance of this visual claim to authorial presence without identity, I want to make a quick recourse to the work of the German artist Gerhard Richter. His appropriation of documentary media, first of all, photography, could be seen as a crucial historical predecessor of the visual series that I explore, though none of the photographers I talked to knew about the German artist in the 80s or 90s, at least like so they say now. So Richter's famous Uncle Rudy is particularly significant here. The portrait is an example of Richter's famous handmade photographs. It is a painting that painstakingly reproduces the photographic original. In Uncle Rudy, the artist actually depicted in 1965 his real relative, Uncle Rudy. In the uniform of the German Wehrmacht, Rudy occupies the center of the picture, smiling at the camera. The painting is mimetic, but it is not transparent, literally. Richter scrubbed with a dry brush the surface of the painting that was just finished to subvert the photorealism of the almost finished work. The blur that emerged in the process of the scrubbing obfuscates the clarity of the message and creates this kind of ghostly image of an awkwardly grinning Nazi officer. Benjamin Buchla, a main scholar of Richter, suggests that Richter used this distortion of Uncle Rudy to respond to the historical specific impediment, as he called it. The blur helped to avoid the conflict between the necessity of constructing historical memory and the inadequacy of the rational means available to do this. Uncle Rudy's obscurity, in other words, was an attempt to render the horror of the Nazi past not by constructing an adequately horrific visual narrative, but by deliberately disorganizing the very process of visual narration. In a sense, as many scholars pointed out, Richter constructed a substitute for the social debate that never occurred. There are several important parallels between Richter's Uncle Rudy and the Minsk photography. In both cases, we are dealing with works that rely on the reproduction of ready-made artifacts, photography or sculptures. In both cases, the pictorial content was purposefully obfuscated through blurring, texturing, or toning. The conventions of the portrait genre were similarly evoked only to be imploded by erasing the subjectivity or by defacing the subject. In both cases, the artist avoided the narrative closure. The burden of interpretation was shifted onto the viewer. Finally, each case emerged as a quiet confrontation that challenged the problematic social condition in which the questions of historical culpability and individual responsibility were barely heard. By drawing these parallels, I am far from suggesting a historical equivalence between Richter's post-Nazi situation and Belarusian post-colonial condition. The unrepresentable that each case was trying to negotiate was very different. But I do think that the similarity of formal engagements with the past that could be neither transformed nor overcome underscores the same basic ontological problem. Namely, when the necessity to represent historical experience, colonial or otherwise, is constrained by the inadequacy of representational tools, one might embrace these tools to expose their inadequacy. Such purposeful combination of semantic minimalism and representational deficiency reached the most developed form in the work of Igor Savchenko, who is slightly younger than Kozhemiakin. He was born in 62. And he's perhaps the most prominent visual scholar, visual artist from Minsk. Savchenko's visual work brings together major aspects of dealing with history through secondhand sources that I have been tracing so far. He also works in series, or cycles, as he calls them, which present a highly eccentric view of the past. They also, the cycles also reject any attempt to point to the historical depth. Instead, they surf history and historical documents. On the one hand, the photographic surface becomes a platform for interaction, but also many individuals are reduced to their material surfaces. For instance, their clothing, the livery again, replaced disappearing subjectivity. Savchenko's work are perfect examples of reported speech. All original materials, the photographs from 1930s, 1960s, were found or bought. However, Savchenko's works are not duplicative. He is a reporter and an actant at the same time. He reproduces the visual discourse of the past, but in the process of this reproduction, he shifts the direction of discussion. Like Kozhemiakin, he avoids frontal confrontations with visual records and appropriates them in a somewhat slanted way, situating himself in the field of visual action indirectly but prominently. He uses the standard textural gestures, blurring or scratching, but he also submits originals to various forms of optic pre-digital transformation. And actually, I need to say, I didn't mention that like all these photographs were done, projects were done before Photoshop and other digital forms, so it's like all done through the magnification, cropping, and sort of like in multiple exposures, so on. So, for instance, like one of his techniques, right, he would enlarge and crop a particular segment multiple times so that a minor detail from the original could reemerge as a new focal center of the visual story. In other cases, figures could be lifted from different sources and recombined in a single frame through multiple exposures. This appropriation of ready-made visual stock works as a process of alteration here. Like in this one, he told me just recently that he just would copy those figures from, that would be marginal figures in somebody else's photograph, and would sort of lift them, sort of expose them, or project them onto the surface that of, is of his own. Yet it is crucial that these vicarious techniques usually do not retrofit representational remains of the past with contemporary content, as was so common, for instance, for many photographic projects in Russia in the 1990s. And I wrote something about that, and so this is, I find, quite typical, actually, where the visual artists would borrow the existing frameworks, a visual template, but then they would kind of make them more contemporary by kind of populating them with sort of contemporary stars. And as you could see, sort of like they are identified, and the whole purpose is precisely sort of to play one identity against the other, which we don't see at all in the materials that I've been talking about today. So the postcolonial appropriation works differently. The reappropriation of historical frames in vicarious photography is not synonymous to the appropriation of history. Control over the process of representation is discovered in the method of revision and recomposition. Breaking the analogous relationship between images and their subjects, this form of appropriation undermines the basic assumption about photographs' ability to convey evidence that can lead back to the body that created the imprint, sort of to quote Christopher Pinney. In other words, like sort of the referential function of the photograph completely disappears. To give you another example. It is indicative that Savchenko's cycles offer no individualizing information about portrayed subjects. Anonymity is the default choice. History is approached mostly as an assemblage of decontextualized historical types, outlines, or imprints. He doesn't date the originals of his cycles either. Instead, he signs the transformed image and indicates the year when the frame was reappropriated, or rather, reauthored. Similarly, it is impossible to tell whether individual photographs of a cycle were derived from the same original or were taken from different ones. All traces of possible pictorial kinship were meticulously suppressed. The final images do not reveal their roots. The past, Savchenko seems to suggest, is not about origin. The second-hand photographic records are torn out of their temporal and historical settings and reclassified under whimsical rubrics like alphabet of gestures, shadows, faceless, mysteria, about love, about happiness, and so on. Externally imposed narrative axes reorganized newly recorded historical traces, suggesting a highly curated vision of the past. In an interview in 2014, I asked him about the ready-made aspect of his visual art and the temporal limits of his sources. So, and I was kind of trying to push him in the direction of nostalgia, asking like, sort of like, well, is it like about your nostalgia or is it about the nostalgia of the young age of your parents? Like he said, nothing. The answer was unexpected. As a photographer, he explained, he could never succeed in capturing things that, I quote, would really interest him. His own photography, he told me, was missing something fundamental. Something was not quite present in it, in his own photography. So he kept looking for something that would, as he put it, appeal to him. In the old photographs, he continued, there are faces, relations, and some kind of connection between people that really touch me. I'm not sure you could see that around anymore. Ready-made photographs were appealing because, I quote again, they were static. They were from a different time, from the epoch that had been completed. They come from a period which is not too remote, and because of this historical proximity, they are not too alien. At the same time, because of their historical distance, they are not too close to your own life, and they still have, as he put it, their own aura. Savchenko's explanations outline the core aspect of vicarious photography and the postcolonial archive. Their indirect quality affords an effective experience of a shared sense of historical continuity. Simultaneously, it offers a safe distance from which this ready-made past could be subjected to various manipulations. For instance, the cycle Shadows, Tenium, he did in, from 1809 till 93, consists of a set of toned photographs in which individuals or groups are placed within empty, grainy environments, like this one. In some cases, Savchenko punctuates the photographic space with flat, dark figures borrowed from other images to create a graphic sequence of almost identical silhouettes. In others, the frame could be occupied only by a single individual facing a blank space. Shadows of history, indeed, these anonymous bodies turn the past into a landscape of ghostly semiotic outlines, into a space populated by recognizable human contours, but unrecognizable individuals. Again, figuration here is purposefully not self-explanatory. There is no pretense of referential representation here. Instead, in Shadows, Savchenko uses photographic records of the past to show us that records are not history, but only traces that manage to survive, and often by accident. If Shadows presented a photographic version of Plato's cave, suggesting to see in history nothing more than a collection of corporeal imprints of unknown origin, then his next series, Alphabet of Gestures, used anonymous semantic configurations to approach history as very tactile, haptic experience. Alphabet turns peripheral elements of the portrait into the center of attention. Savchenko shifts our gaze to the margins, and by doing this, he's able to reveal the nuanced choreography of human limbs, usually overshadowed by more noticeable facial expressions. When seen together, Alphabet's gestures offer a strange body spectacle, familiar and alienating at the same time. The photographic fragments here clearly came from static public portraits. However, in their defaced and magnified incarnations, these hieroglyphs of extremities suddenly convert the alphabet of gestures into an archive of a voyeur, as if disclosing the fetishistic nature of our desire to approach the historical detail too closely. Six cycles of Savchenko's mysteries straddle in between the flattening distance of shadows and the fetishistic obsession of alphabets. In the series, Savchenko uses overpainting in addition to his usual cropping and refocusing. For example, his Mysterium 1, that's late 80s, contains a set of portraits in which red dots or red lines were drawn over people's faces or in their background. Savchenko told me in an interview again that he used paint to highlight already existing cracks and scratches of the original photographs. As he put it, I quote, "For me, these defects of the originals were traces of time, traces of those forces, of those elements that existed during this period. There was something powerful going on back then, hence the red color is the most appropriate in my view." The overpainting, in other words, is not only a way of retracing history, but also it is a way of establishing a haptic contact with it. It is a form of access to the past and, at the same time, a tool of editorial control over it. Some images had a handwritten sentence caption at the bottom of the margin. So in the end, these interventions result in an intricate palimpsest of layers of appropriation. So we have a cropped image of an acquired photograph which has been painted over, narrativized, signed, and dated below. What this layering allows Savchenko to achieve then is a non-committal relation with the past that is kept at a distance and at the same time is being imprinted with marks of adoption. The adoption is often more formal than substantive, and the alleged caption, yes, of course, like in this one, yes, of course, but it doesn't mean that the Last Judgment doesn't exist. So it makes no sense to me, but sort of helps little to clarify the nature of the artist's intervention. But like the red paint, it chronicles the act of intervention. So if ready-made nature of this vicarious photography effaced the authorial self, then multiple tactical occupations of the photographic surface reinstate the authorial presence in a non-transparent and obfuscating way. It is useful to contrast Savchenko's work and his explanation with another painting by Gerhard Richter, somewhat similar from the point of view of its technical characteristics. So Richter's Party from 1963 is a painted reproduction of a photograph from a German literary magazine in which four glamorous women and a man drink punch smiling at the camera. While recreating the photograph, Richter substantially corrected the original. In the painting, people are covered with bloody scars. The scars are not merely illusionistic. They are physical cuts in the canvas, which have been stapled, stitched, and painted over with bright red. Analyzing the painting, Eckhard Gillen, a scholar of Richter, reads slashes and bloody additions in Party as an example of capitalist realism, as materialized signs of Richter's critical distancing from the content that he recreated. Savchenko's painterly interventions do not seem to have any obvious critical message. His overpainting refocalizes the image not by offering a counter-narrative, but by amplifying the factura of the time. Enhancing his authorial presence, he retraces the elemental forces of the period, bringing them to the fore within the frame of the borrowed image. What Richter's work helps to illuminate, then, is a different status of borrowed formations in the project of the Minsk School. The goal of vicarious appropriation is not to antagonize found objects pictorially, but to use them as vehicles of substitutive presence. And finally, faceless, the last and my most favorite cycle, and I'm finishing. So faceless brings together multiple techniques of the scopic revision of the past that I've been talking about today. The cycle includes individual portraits in which faces of individuals are completely hollowed out. Also, there are mini-series in which individuals disappear gradually, one after another, and I'll show you one so you could appreciate it. Okay. Well, there is nothing particularly sinister about overall compositions of photographic content, contents of faceless images. The traces of disappearance do produce a disturbing effect. Facial erasures are not complete. People's hair, for instance, remains kind of intact almost. And these spaces of surgically executed non-presence look like entry points into another dimension beyond the picture. The disappeared demand for explanation, but there would be none, not even in the form of a usually obfuscating caption. Removing traces of interiority sufficiently leaves these negative spaces open for each and any interpretation. When several works from the cycle were exhibited abroad, like here actually in the US, curators tended to see in them a reminder of Stalinism, of all those people and representations that were made to disappear. And I'm just giving you sort of a standard example that's from Rodchenko's album, what is it, 10 Years of Uzbekistan, and he himself sort of, it's his personal album. I mean, he produced it, he owned a copy of more than one, and he gradually would sort of mark these people out. Blacken them, like in this case, like Ekramov was jailed in 37 and was killed in 38. So, and the album came out in 34. So, during our conversation in Minsk, Savchenko completely dismissed this interpretation, like sort of that there is a certain familiar resemblance between these approaches, as having nothing in common with his own intention. These people are faceless, because they are human models, he insisted. They present different models of people in different life situations. Therefore, there are no faces, just mother as such, or child as such, that types. This cycle is about a universal human being, человек вообще. I had no reason not to believe him. After all, when in the late 1920s and early 30s, Malevich was forced to abandon his cubes and circles, he switched to producing peasants, girls, and the people of the future, whose identities were similarly hollowed out. Faceless and de-individualized, they were also supposed to represent universal human types and social categories, shells to inhabit, models to emulate. Unlike Malevich's generalized people of the future, Savchenko's universal beings of the past were not imagined. They were distilled and abstracted from historical records. His universal beings are decontextualized and anonymized, but they did offer templates of an inhabitable past by pointing to experiences, situations, and relations that did take place. What Savchenko outlines in his cycles then is a collection of modalities that make the ready-made history accessible for changes and open for interactions. Through operations of fragmentation and recomposition, he refocused historical records. He also reactivated the available past by defacing its subjects and retracing its elemental forces. His art of tactical occupation did not produce an alternative version of history, but it did something more important. It envisioned Soviet history as a space of new formal possibilities. More generally, as the visual archive of the Minsk School demonstrates, the appropriation of visual conventions of the Soviet period does not necessarily need to result in their duplication, nor does this appropriation require the mandatory ironic position. The visual artists whom I discussed employed the visual language of the vanished empire in order to disassociate themselves from the Soviet practices of photographic recording. Of course, there is a certain danger in replacing photography as a tool of documentary recording with photography as a speculative practice which uses historical forms for building a foundation for hypothetical versions of the past. There's a clear threat of what T.J. Demos defined as, a quote, the near complete disconnection of photography from social reality. lived experience now appears merely as a secondary effect of the photograph's own creative fabrication. They have tried to show such disconnection doesn't have to take a shape of a flight from reality. As the visual archive of the Minsk School demonstrates, this distancing could also provide the necessary opening for generating forms of critical engagement with available photo objects left behind by the vanished empire. Through erasing subjectivity and abstracting imprints of lived experience, the vicarious photography articulated a mode of dealing with history that allowed presence without identity or identification. Thank you.